The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
We are not in News Talk. We are not even in Ireland. We are in Canada. We're in Toronto. And I am here with William Peat, who is Executive Director of the Canada-Ireland Foundation. And we're in, well, what is a beautiful building on the outside and will be a beautiful building on the inside. Some of the noise you can hear in the background is because it is in a state of disrepair, state of repair. So, William, tell me, where are we?
Yes, we're in the Corlick Building, which is right on the waterfront of Toronto. And it is the building we're renovating. It's from the 1940s that we're renovating into our arts and culture space here.
Yeah, so listen, it's a beautiful, beautiful building. And we'll get into some of this in a moment. But right beside it are these massive big silos that I actually saw this morning when I was down this way. So tell me a little bit about what they represent in terms of the industry that used to be here and Ireland's connection to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Toronto was very much an industrial town right up until the 70s. On the waterfront at one point there were 28 railways that would be busy shipping things around the city and throughout Canada. But particularly because of the Northern Irish connection to Toronto, there was a massive linen industry and there was a massive brewing industry. So there was about 20 breweries and distilleries. At one part of the city to this day, there's an area called the Distillery District, which was the Gutterm & Wartz Distillery, which was the largest whiskey distillery in the world at one point. And all of the grain for that, which was brought down on ships, came right beside us here into the Canada Malting Company. They were stored in the silos, and just north of this building, gone now, were what was the kiln operation. So they would start roasting the hops, put them back onto trains, and then send them to breweries, distilleries. Kellogg's also had a big factory here. So yeah, this was very much an industrial core in at the turn of the century, right up until the 90s, actually.
Towards the turn of the last century, how would you describe the nature of the Irish community here, particularly in comparison to the community south of the border in the States, which is maybe a kind of a migrant experience we're much more culturally familiar with?
I always say Ireland and America are like cousins, but Ireland and Canada are like siblings. So if we take it way back to just after the Napoleonic War, there was a massive immigration of Irish people, but 80% of them were Protestant Irish, mostly from what is now Northern Ireland.
The Ulster Scots coming to
Canada. It maintained its connection to Britain. It was originally a dominion and it's now part of the Commonwealth. And so it was a natural place for people, Ulster Scots, to come to North America more broadly, while people from the Republic tended to go to the United States. However, during the famine, which we'll talk about later, that flipped. So all of a sudden you had about 90% of the migrants coming were Catholics. And so that's actually led, between both of those immigrations, to a roughly 50-50 percentage. So there's a huge Northern Irish population here, and then there's a huge population from what is now the Republic. So it's much more nuanced. It wouldn't be as wearing your nationalism on your sleeve in the same way that you would see down in the United States. So we tend to get on very well here, and people tend to talk about their Irish identity in a more nuanced fashion than we would sometimes see down south.
And how did that, from a historical point of view, say during periods like 1916 or 1918 onwards, during all of that, what was the nature of the conversation that was had, say, amongst the Irish community in Canada?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, complicated, I think, would be the answer.
Yeah.
There was, you know, a lot of people who volunteered for the Canadian Armed Forces in World War I and World War II were Irishmen as well. And there is a kind of a seam of thought that actually Irish people were some of the highest percentage of volunteers between the British Army, the Americans and the Canadians to join that. But we did see a lot of Fenians coming over and speaking here in St. Lawrence Hall, in the Empire Club, in a lot of different places. So that conversation was deeply rooted here. But I think it was more trying to reconcile how Ireland can maintain its connectivity to itself, as opposed to trying to push for one version or another. But I do believe, I'm trying to remember now, but I think the Irish Republic was actually first declared here by a politician who came over. I'll have to look that up, but there is a big connection to that as well.
After a couple of drinks, I think we'll find. But anyway,
yes,
that's a whole other story. In terms of the space we're in and the work that the foundation does, you were telling me a little bit earlier as we were making our way down here that the nature of that work is kind of changing, and you've got a different vision as to what it might do in the future. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're saying we're going from a marker to a maker. So traditionally, when the foundation first started, it was purely a history organization. It built Ireland Park, which we'll talk about later, and really kind of commemorated that story of the Irish in Canada. We're now continuing to do that, but also very much engaging in the future of that story. So we're seeing a deeper connection between the island of Ireland and Canada in a way that we've never seen previously, and we want to be part of that conversation. So we're engaging in the contemporary arts, we're engaging in conversations to try and leverage that international connectivity that Ireland and Canada have as liberal democracies that have a broadly similar outlook on the world, and we want to help curate and create those conversations together. So we're doing that through music, through theatre, and through talks and discussions, all which will happen here in the Corner.
And so when is it going to be done and dusted?
It'll be open for March 2026.
Right. Well, listen, we wish you the best of luck with it. Let's nip outside, though, to the memorial and everything out there, and we'll continue the conversation. So bear with us. Okay, so listen, we've made our way outside. We're just around the corner from the building. And you might explain to people who don't have the benefit of seeing what we're seeing, William, what I'm looking at.
Yes, so we're right beside the main part of Ireland Park, which is a 400-ton sculpture of Kilkenny limestone that contains about 730 names of Irish migrants who perished in the city upon arrival during the famine. Actually, within that 730 names are also 11 of the carers, so the doctors, nurses and medical orders who gave their lives while tending to those Irish as well.
And then beyond it as well, for people who maybe come here, they'll see sculptures that are reminiscent to them of similar sculptures in Dublin.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is a reciprocal park of the departure series that are right outside the CHQ building on Customs House Quay in Dublin. So Rowan Gillespie designed seven sculptures that were there for the 150th anniversary in 1997. And that began a journey with our founder and chair, a gentleman called Robert Kearns, to do a reciprocal park in Toronto. So these are called the Arrival series.
And there's two fewer here compared to Dublin.
Yeah, so there are seven in Dublin and there are five here. And that speaks to the 20% loss of life on board ship or upon arrival from what was then known as ship fever, and we now know was a typhus epidemic.
The figures are astounding, really, the numbers. So 40,000 over a couple of years, 40,000 Irish would have landed close to this spot.
Yeah, so the city of Toronto itself was about 20,000 people, and about 38,500 Irish migrants landed in on them in one season. So what happened was, the famine happened over several years, as you're aware, and for the first 2 years, the main migration was to the United States, so 1845 and 1846. But having taken people in for 2 years, the Americans said, we're not doing this anymore. And so in the third year, 1847, they said no. So the Colonial Office told Canada, you have land, the Irish need to go somewhere, so you have to take them. And so over 120,000 Irish landed into Canada in general and just overwhelmed many of the cities.
Was there a pushback from people who were here, even that Ulster Scots kind of tradition who had migrated, given just the overwhelming numbers?
Yeah, so, you know, it's definitely a bit of a mixed bag for that. There was a bit of pushback, but overall, no, there was a huge amount of kindness from Canadians. But then also the government was very organized to get people out of the cities as quickly as possible to area of settlement so you could have a farm. So there was a thing, really, the Canadian dream, which was you could own your own farm. So you could own 150 acres by coming to Canada. So these would have been tenant farmers with 1 to 2 acres of, you know, barely arable land in Ireland who, within 10 years of coming to Canada, were owning 100 and more acres of farm, of really good soil.
I guess one of the consequences of moving people out of the cities onto their own land is you never got that kind of ghettoization that you would have had south.
Yes, absolutely. So that was a big thing. And people would remain kind of roughly homogenous. So, for example, this year is the 200th anniversary of, there's a town called Peterborough, and that was the Peter Robinson expedition to Canada. So that still is like 80% Irish Canadians live in that city. So it's amazing how you have these entire towns. So you could literally move, you know, Turnmenfechan in Ireland would move to Turnmenfechan in Canada, and everyone would kind of replicate themselves and recreate the town almost. And obviously with land came, you know, perpetual wealth. You were able to till your farm every year. You were able to send your kids to school. So it just created a vastly different experience for Irish people.
Having wealth gives you a stake in a society. You know what I mean? Suddenly you're not the person looking to upend the status quo. You're looking to maintain it.
Yeah, absolutely. So so that being able to be successful in this country, and then also, you know, being successful within a broader kind of a dominion and then a Commonwealth mandate as well. I think people didn't want to be kind of as violent and as aggressive as they could have been as well. So yeah, it created a very different outlook. Even though people were supportive of the nationalist cause, it was much more through rhetoric and through diplomacy and through politics that they were looking for that to happen, rather than through the gun, which is obviously ended up what happening.
It's a beautiful part of the lakefront down here, and the building from the outside as well looks great. It'll look great, I'm sure, when it's done and dusted. And we wish you the absolute best of luck with it all, William.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, William Pete, who is Executive Director with the Canada Ireland Foundation.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.